And you're back with Annie on 3CR Breakfast, and we're going to go back to 2013 to the making and unmaking of the East-West Link with the author James C. Murphy. G'day, James. How are you?
G'day, good. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah. Absolutely fascinating read for me, because I was one of those people that went every day to stop the drilling, covering it for 3CR, 5 a.m. in the morning. So it was fascinating to read your take on the East-West Link, because you do it with an academic eye. So tell my listeners how you approached your book.
Yeah, look, I tried to do justice to some of the people that were getting up early in the morning and heading out to the picket line, but also to cover some of the other aspects of the whole drama. I wanted to sort of walk through the saga of East-West Link from three different directions. And down there on the street and in the courts and at the ballot box is sort of one walkthrough that I do of it. But I try to look at a couple of others as well. I follow the making of East-West Link through the Premier's office, bureaucracy, and kind of with all the different vested interests and lobbyists sort of pushing for these projects and stuff like that. And then to watch how all of their best efforts to get that project realised were undone. And by people who were picketing and people who were bringing court cases and all the rest of it. So my approach, was to take it on from three different perspectives and to use that as a test for, you know, which forces are most important in our infrastructure in Melbourne.
And one of the things that you do is tell people why we have academics who do doctorates, because that's where this began, this book, because you apply certain, not only do you do a huge amount of research and discover that the Freedom of Information Act isn't fit for purpose, but, and we don't have to do that, because you did.
Yeah, that's true.
But also you apply various academic theories to each of these studies, which is really neat. I find that really neat.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, I had the kind of privilege of time.
7 years, in fact.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I had time to do my PhD thesis, and that gave me lots of time to be able to indulge in, Freedom of Information Act applications, and I made maybe 30 or 35 of them, and maybe four of them turned up anything good. So, yeah, I've been through the wars with the FOI Act and have some grumpy musings about how it could be better in the start of the book. But, you're right, I had time to try out a few different theories of how the political system works, how we make decisions in Australia, which players are important in the policymaking process. And I got to try out, you know, the theory that leaders are kind of in control of the process if they have certain power resources to exercise. And I could kind of test that out on this case with the Premiers Napthine and Baillieu, whether they were in control of the policymaking process when East-West Link sort of first got up. And then I could test out theories of bureaucracy and where their power comes from and how they sort of control the agenda for politicians, even if the premiers would rather not build a big fat road project like East-West Link. Maybe there's a roads bureaucracy that is all powerful that convinces them to build it anyway. Finally, I got to test out different theories of how people from outside the halls of power, people down on the street or on the picket line or in the courts or campaigning at the ballot box, how they can take control of a project like this and sort of turn the tables on the government and change the outcome. And I got to test all of those, and it was good fun. Yeah,
well, the timing and the theatre of it, because it was very theatrical, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And there were, like, the kind of campaign in front of the media was, I argue, very important to changing perspectives and to changing who felt that they had a stake in the issue. The framing of these questions matters a lot. And I argued kind of in the book that I thought that some of the campaigning against the project sort of created a counter frame. Certainly the pickets, I think, helped in changing the frame from being about what kind of project is the right project for Melbourne to being about social license. And I thought that was a really important shift because it gave a lot of people, you know, living in the inner north of Melbourne, a stake because they are the community and they got to say, well, if it is up to me and it's about social license, I'm not sure I'm ready to give license to this project. So that changed things, and it made a lot of people feel like they had a stake, which stopped the
It did, because the business about no trains and trains, no roads, but trains, but also there was a lot of effort went into bringing that message to the outer suburbs as well, that it wasn't just an inner city, latte sipping set. That it was influencing. I mean, it was such a lot of things, like even down to the fact that the government was going to use all the infrastructure funds on this one project, and so all the rural people didn't get anything. You know, like there was a lot of work done to do that reframing.
Absolutely, yeah. So, and there was campaigning. You're right. The campaigning out in the burbs was important, and even in the region. And I think. As kind of a piece of political craft, East West Link was poorly crafted because it put all the eggs in one basket. Even in terms of like savvy politics, it's not all that savvy because it's one big fat project in the middle of the city, and the Liberal government at the time was asking all communities to imagine themselves benefited by that, and that was a hard sell, especially when other kind of parties at the 2014 election were saying we're gonna. You know, if it's Labor, we're going to get rid of level crossing removals, you know, and everyone could imagine that it was their level crossing. Or other parties, you know, are saying we're going to do all these other different projects out in the regions or in the suburbs, which allowed people to kind of imagine their lives improved in a way that East West Link kind of struggled to sell.
Yeah, it was so undemocratic. I know your book is one book, but I do remember at the time the line in the sand, the aggression coming from the big end of town, you know, at certain events. I remember people being abused in no uncertain terms for picketing there was this big dinner at one of the expensive hotels where a whole lot of the bureaucrats as well as the... shakers and movers in the private world, you know, the abuse that was, you know, like you're just dirt on the footpath. How dare you question us? It was classic. It was absolutely classic.
And I think it springs from a sense of like that they own the process and that they're the right decision makers, right? And one of the things that you get in a battle like this is always. A push by the advocates for change to expand the conflict and to expand participation in the process. And the people who are quite happy with the status quo, with the way that we usually make big infrastructure decisions, they try to close that down and to say that anyone trying to come into this decision-making process from the outside are sort of, you know, carpetbaggers, or they're illegitimate in some regard, and they'll be really resistant to people trying to assert a level of control over these decisions. And I think we saw plenty of that. You know, the government at the time, they passed. I'm sure people recall that they passed these quite draconian anti-protest laws, and it was kind of not a secret that a big chunk of the reason why were the pickets. Against East West Link.
Yeah, yeah. That's where all the men in pajamas started to, critical incident, whatever they're called.
Yeah. Yeah, the wallopers were sent in to West Garth Street and to like sleepy Collingwood and taken off, you know, other jobs to police the pickets in this quite desperate attempt. To reassert control over the kind of geotechnical drilling in the inner north, and it sort of didn't go all that well. And I've sort of argued that the pickets, I think they had a small material impact on the kind of preparatory works for the project, but had a very large kind of framing and media impact, and that was the big contribution. in changing minds. Yeah.
But the thing about that was so impressive, besides the tactic, there was obviously tactical chess playing going on. But also the other thing that was fascinating was how many people who had so many skills applied themselves across the board. So the VCAT stuff, the legal stuff, there were a whole lot of people who were older people who were retired, but who had absolutely sharp, razor sharp vision into the bureaucracies, and they applied their skills.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it was quite an experienced kind of cohort of activists. And often, you know, they weren't always coordinated. They weren't always doing, they weren't always singing from the same...
They just applied themselves.
Go on, sorry.
They just applied themselves to the task.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think all of that collective experience across all of those various protesters and activists and stuff like that, I think it paid off in this case. And it helped, I think, as well, that it was this polarizing project on an environmental level. And you had a lot of people who were experienced from the environment movement decide to make East West Link their big kind of target for 2013, 2014. And so, yeah, there was a lot of collective experience in the nominal room, right? They weren't in one room together, but they were all working towards the same end of destroying the project, and that was successful.
Yeah, well, the making and unmaking of East West Link is a case study, and it's been published by the Melbourne University Press. And you have taken great pains to write in a very readable way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've pushed for that. I remember when I was writing my PhD thesis, supervisors and examiners sometimes saying, "Oh, you're writing a little bit casually for academia." And I just get in trouble sometimes being a little bit inadequately highfalutin, right? So I didn't have to change it all that much for the book, and I take pain. Yeah, to write in a way that doesn't close anyone out and that takes everyone along for the ride. So I want this book to be something that people who were involved at the time or people who want to understand Melbourne and their own city and how politics in this town work, to be able to read it and it, to not be just for academic wonks and people in the ivory tower.
Yeah, well, it goes beside the book that was written at the time by Anthony Mayne, I guess.
Yeah, and I read that, and part of my approach in this book takes for granted that book is out there, and that goes into really tight detail on how the pickets worked. So I touch on the pickets and talk a little bit about their effect, but don't quite go into the blow by blow story because that book's out there and it kind of does that job. So yeah, I think they're companion items.
And there's a little side issue that was because of your academic eye. You go through when you talk about the premiers and the power of the premiers, you actually talk about the increasingly presidential nature of the prime ministership in Australia and premiers, which is actually very important now that people are talking about the Uluru Statement and the idea of an Indigenous group that advises Parliament. You know, it's a very interesting because that will would change that dynamic.
Yeah, that's quite right. So the kind of direction of concentration has been towards more power for the chief executive, whether that's the Premier or the Prime Minister, and the kind of role of Parliament has sort of dwindled. However, that's almost more a function of us having very strong and disciplined political parties, which are happy to serve the leader, at least until the leader does the wrong thing and they're ready to turf them and replace the new leader. I think that actually the presidential... There's sort of this whole thesis in Australian academia, or a controversy around the presidentialisation thesis, about whether it's kind of a bit ahistorical, about whether maybe there were very strong and powerful prime ministers and premiers, you know, 100 years ago, and that maybe it's sort of an ebb and flow rather than a one-way street of leaders getting more and more power.
Mm.
And I kind of go more for that latter position that we've actually seen some very, you know, Premier Bolte of Victoria, Henry Bolte was an absurdly powerful premier, and that's, you know, 1950s, 1960s, into the 70s, early 70s. And that's sort of at a time when the state was much less complex, I guess, and much smaller, and he could kind of run the state almost as a one-man show, and everyone kind of deferred to what Bolte and his aura had to say about what we should do about shall we hang this this criminal, or shall we build this bridge, or shall we, you know, and they call him the salt and pepper premier because he was on everything.
Anyway, the point is that the making and unmaking of East West Link has got many things to offer anybody who was to pick it up. It tells you about the actual battle, but it also looks at a whole lot of other sort of its role in infrastructure policy making.
Yeah, along the way, we encounter lots of different trends and issues in Australian politics and policy making, including, you know, the power of leaders, the power of the bureaucracy, and the power of, like, social movements, protest movements and stuff like that, and how they shape things. So it's a good excuse to go for a wonderful, like, ride through some of those big picture issues.
Thank you very much for talking to me this morning, James.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. And that was James C. Murphy, who has written this book, The Making and Unmaking of East West Link, and it is published by Melbourne University Press.